Mr. Max, will you be prepared to present your plea tomorrow? The judge asked. I will, Your Honor. Back in his cell, Bigger tumbled lifelessly onto his cot. Soon it'll all be over, he thought. Tomorrow might be the last day. He hoped so. His sense of time was gone. Night and day were merged now. The next morning, he was awake in his cell when Max came. On his way to court, he wondered what Max would say about him. Could Max really save his life? In the act of thinking the thought, he thrust it from him. If he kept hope from his mind, then whatever happened would seem natural. As he was led down the hall, past windows, he saw that the mob and the troops still surrounded the courthouse. The building was still jammed with muttering people. Policemen had to make an aisle for him in the crowd. A pang of fear shot through him when he saw that he had been the first to get to the table. Max was somewhere behind him, lost in the crowd. It was then that he felt more deeply than ever what Max had grown to mean to him. He was defenseless now. What was there to prevent those people from coming across those railings and dragging him into the street now that Max was not here? He sat, not daring to look round, conscious that every eye was upon him. Max's presence during the trial had made him feel that somewhere in that crowd that stared at him so steadily and resentfully was something he could cling to, if only he could get at it. There smoldered in him the hope that Max had made him feel in the first long talk they had had. But he did not want to risk trying to make it flare into flame now, not with his trial and the words of hate from Buckley. But neither did he snuff it out. He nursed it, kept it as his last refuge. When Max came, Bigger saw that his face was pale and drawn. There were dark rings beneath his eyes. Max laid a hand on Bigger's knee and whispered, I'm going to do all I can, son. Court opened, and the judge said, Are you ready to proceed, Mr. Max? Yes, Your Honor. Max rose, ran his hand through his white hair, and went to the front of the room. He turned and half-faced the judge and Buckley, looking out over Bigger's head to the crowd. He cleared his throat. Your Honor, never in my life have I risen in court to make a plea with a firmer conviction in my heart. I know that what I have to say here today touches the destiny of an entire nation. My plea is for more than one man and one people. Perhaps it is in a manner fortunate that the defendant has committed one of the darkest crimes in our memory. For if we can encompass the life of this man and find out what has happened to him, if we can understand how subtly and yet strongly his life and fate are linked to ours, if we can do this, perhaps we shall find the key to our future, that rare vantage point upon which every man and woman in this nation can stand and view how inextricably our hopes and fears of today create the exaltation and doom of tomorrow. Your Honor, I have no desire to be disrespectful to this court, but I must be honest. A man's life is at stake. And not only is this man a criminal, but he is a black criminal. And as such, he comes into this court under a handicap, notwithstanding our pretensions that all are equal before the law. This man is different. Even though his crime differs from similar crimes only in degree, the complex forces of society have isolated here for us a symbol, a test symbol. The prejudices of men have stained this symbol, like a germ stained for examination under the microscope. The unremitting hate of men has given us a psychological distance that will enable us to see this tiny social symbol in relation to our whole sick social organism. I say, Your Honor, that the mere act of understanding Bigger Thomas will be a thawing out of ice-bound impulses, a dragging of the sprawling forms of dread out of the night of fear into the light of reason, an unveiling of the unconscious ritual of death in which we, like sleepwalkers, have participated so dreamlike and thoughtlessly. But I make no excessive claims, Your Honor. I do not deal in magic. I do not say that if we understand this man's life, we shall solve all our problems, or that when we have all the facts at our disposal, we shall automatically know how to act. Life is not that simple. But I do say that if, after I have finished, you feel that death is necessary, then you are making an open choice. What I want to do is inject into the consciousness of this court, through the discussion of evidence, the two possible courses of action open to us, and the inevitable consequences flowing from each. And then, if we say death, let us mean it. And if we say life, let us mean that too. But whatever we say, let us know upon what ground we are putting our feet, what the consequences are for us and for those whom we judge. Your Honor, I would have you believe that I am not insensible to the deep burden of responsibility I am throwing upon your shoulders by the manner in which I have insisted upon conducting the defense of this boy's life, and in my resolve to place before you the entire degree of his guilt for judgment. But under the circumstances, what else could I have done? Night after night, I have lain without sleep, trying to think of a way to picture to you and to the world the causes and reasons why this Negro boy sits here, a self-confessed murderer. But every time I thought I had discovered a vital piece of evidence bearing upon his fate, I could hear in my mind's ear the low, angry muttering of that mob, which the state troops are holding at bay beyond that window. How can I asked myself, make my voice heard with effect above the hungry yelping of hounds on the hunt? How can I asked myself, make the picture of what has happened to this boy show plain and powerful upon a screen of sober reason, when 1,000 newspaper and magazine artists have already drawn it in lurid ink upon 1,000,000 sheets of public print? Dare I, deeply mindful of this boy's background and race, put his fate in the hands of a jury, not of his peers, but of an alien and hostile race, whose minds are already conditioned by the press of the nation, a press which has already reached a decision as to his guilt, and in countless editorials suggested the measure of his punishment? No, I could not. It would be better if we had no courts of law than that justice should be administered under such conditions. An outright lynching would be more honest than a mock trial. Rather that courts be abolished, and each man buy arms and proceed to protect himself or make war for what he thinks is rightfully his own, than that a man should be tried by men who have already made up their minds that he is guilty. I could not have placed at the disposal of a jury the evidence, so general and yet so confoundingly specific, so impalpable and yet so disastrous in its terrible consequences, consequences which have affected my client and account for his being here today before the bar of judgment with his life at stake. I could not have done that and have been honest with myself or with this boy. So today I come to face this court, rejecting a trial by jury, willingly entering a plea of guilty, asking, in the light of the laws of this state, that this boy's life be spared for reasons which I believe affect the foundations of our civilization. The most habitual thing for this court to do is to take the line of least resistance and follow the suggestion of the state's attorney and say, death. And that would be the end of this case. But that would not be the end of this crime. That is why this court must do otherwise. There are times, Your Honor, when reality bears features of such an impelling moral complexion that it is impossible to follow the hewn path of expediency. There are times when life's ends are so raveled that reason and sense cry out that we stop and gather them together again before we can proceed. What atmosphere surrounds this trial? Are the citizens soberly intent upon seeing that the law is executed, that retribution is dealt out in measure with the offense, that the guilty and only the guilty is caught and punished? No. Every conceivable prejudice has been dragged into this case. The authorities of the city and state deliberately inflamed the public mind to the point where they could not keep the peace without martial law. Responsible to nothing but their own corrupt conscience, the newspapers and the prosecution launched the ridiculous claim that the Communist Party was in some way linked to these two murders. Only here in court yesterday morning did the state's attorney cease implying that Bigger Thomas was guilty of other crimes, crimes which he could not prove. And because I, a Jew, dared defend this Negro boy, for days my mail has been flooded with threats against my life. The manner in which Bigger Thomas was captured, the hundreds of innocent Negro homes invaded, the scores of Negroes assaulted upon the streets, the dozens who were thrown out of their jobs, the barrage of lies poured out from every source against a defenseless people. All of this was something unheard of in democratic lands. The hunt for Bigger Thomas served as an excuse to terrorize the entire Negro population, to arrest hundreds of communists, to raid labor union headquarters and workers' organizations. Indeed, the tone of the press, the silence of the church, the attitude of the prosecution, and the stimulated temper of the people are of such a nature as to indicate that more than revenge is being sought upon a man who has committed a crime.
This ends Disc 13. Native Son, Disc 14.
What is the cause of all this high feeling and excitement? Is it the crime of Bigger Thomas? Were Negroes liked yesterday and hated today because of what he has done? Were labor unions and workers' halls raided solely because a Negro committed a crime? Did those white bones lying on that table evoke the gasp of horror that went up from the nation? Did the feeling against the Jews in the city rise only because a Jewish lawyer is defending a black boy? Your Honor, you know that that is not the case. All of the factors in the present hysteria existed before Bigger Thomas was ever heard of. Negroes, workers, and labor unions were hated as much yesterday as they are today. Crimes of even greater brutality and horror have been committed in this city. Gangsters have killed and have gone free to kill again. But none of that brought forth an indignation to equal this. Your Honor, that mob did not come here of its own accord. It was incited. Until a week ago, those people lived their lives as quietly as always. Who then fanned this latent hate into fury? Whose interest is that thoughtless and misguided mob serving? Why did every agency of communication in the city suddenly spew forth lies, telling our citizens that they had to protect what they owned against Bigger Thomas and men like him? Who provoked this hysteria so that they might profit by it? The state's attorney knows, for he promised the Loop bankers that if he were reelected, demonstrations for relief would be stopped. The governor of the state knows, for he has pledged the Manufacturers Association that he would use troops against workers who went out on strike. The mayor knows, for he told the merchants of the city that the budget would be cut down, that no new taxes would be imposed to satisfy the clamor of the masses of the needy. There is guilt in the rage that demands that this man's life be snuffed out quickly. There is fear in the hate and impatience which impels the action of the mob congregated upon the streets beyond that window, each of them, the mob and the mob masters, the wire pullers and the frightened, the leaders and their pet vassals, know and feel that their lives are built upon a historical deed of wrong against many people. People from whose lives they have bled their leisure and their luxury. Their feeling of guilt is as deep as that of the boy who sits here on trial today. Fear and hate and guilt are the keynotes of this drama. Your Honor, for the sake of this boy and myself, I wish I could bring to this court evidence of a morally worthier nature. I wish I could say that love, ambition, jealousy, the quest for adventure, or any of the more romantic feelings were back of these two murders. If I could honestly invest the hapless actor in this fateful drama with feelings of a loftier cast, my task would be easier, and I would feel confident of the outcome. The odds would be with me, for I would be appealing to men bound by common ideals, to judge with pity and understanding one of their brothers who erred and fell in struggle. But I have no choice in this matter. Life has cut this cloth, not I. We must deal here with the raw stuff of life, emotions and impulses and attitudes as yet unconditioned by the strivings of science and civilization. We must deal here with a first wrong, which, when committed by us, was understandable and inevitable. And then we must deal with the long, trailing black sense of guilt stemming from that wrong, a sense of guilt which self-interest and fear would not let us atone. And we must deal here with the hot blasts of hate engendered in others by that first wrong, and then the monstrous and horrible crimes flowing from that hate, a hate which has seeped down into the hearts and molded the deepest and most delicate sensibilities of multitudes. We must deal here with a dislocation of life involving millions of people, a dislocation so vast as to stagger the imagination, so fraught with tragic consequences as to make us rather not want to look at it or think of it, so old that we would rather try to view it as an order of nature and strive with uneasy conscience and false moral fervor to keep it so. We must deal here, on both sides of the fence, among whites as well as blacks, among workers as well as employers, with men and women in whose minds there loom good and bad of such height and weight that they assume proportions of abnormal aspect and construction. When situations like this arise, instead of men feeling that they are facing other men, they feel that they are facing mountains, floods, seas, forces of nature whose size and strength focus the minds and emotions to a degree of tension unusual in the quiet routine of urban life. Yet this tension exists within the limits of urban life, undermining it and supporting it in the same gesture of being. Allow me, Your Honor, before I proceed to cast blame and ask for mercy, to state emphatically that I do not claim that this boy is a victim of injustice, nor do I ask that this court be sympathetic with him. That is not my object in embracing his character and his cause. It is not to tell you only of suffering that I stand here today, even though there are frequent lynchings and floggings of Negroes throughout the country. If you react only to that part of what I say, then you too are caught as much as he in the mire of blind emotion, and this vicious game will roll on like a bloody river to a bloodier sea. Let us banish from our minds the thought that this is an unfortunate victim of injustice. The very concept of injustice rests upon a premise of equal claims, and this boy here today makes no claim upon you. If you think or feel that he does, then you, too, are blinded by a feeling as terrible as that which you condemn in him, and without as much justification. The feeling of guilt, which has caused all of the mob fear and mob hysteria, is the counterpart of his own hate. Rather, I plead with you to see a mode of life in our midst, a mode of life stunted and distorted, but possessing its own laws and claims, an existence of men growing out of the soil prepared by the collective, but blind will of 100 million people. I beg you to recognize human life draped in a form and guise alien to ours, but springing from a soil plowed and sown by all our hands. I ask you to recognize the laws and processes flowing from such a condition. Understand them. Seek to change them. If we do none of these, then we should not pretend horror or surprise when thwarted life expresses itself in fear and hate and crime. This is life, new and strange. Strange because we fear it. New because we have kept our eyes turned from it. This is life lived in cramped limits and expressing itself not in terms of good and bad, but in terms of its own fulfillment. Men are men and life is life, and we must deal with them as they are. And if we want to change them, we must deal with them in the form in which they exist and have their being. Your Honor, I must still speak in general terms, for the background of this boy must be shown, a background which has acted powerfully and importantly upon his conduct. Our forefathers came to these shores and faced a harsh and wild country. They came here with a stifled dream in their hearts, from lands where their personalities had been denied, as even we have denied the personality of this boy. They came from cities of the old world where the means to sustain life were hard to get or own. They were colonists, and they were faced with a difficult choice. They had either to subdue this wild land or be subdued by it. We need but turn our eyes upon the imposing sweep of streets and factories and buildings to see how completely they have conquered. But in conquering, they used others, used their lives. Like a miner using a pick or a carpenter using a saw, they bent the will of others to their own. Lives to them were tools and weapons to be wielded against a hostile land and climate. I do not say this in terms of moral condemnation. I do not say it to rouse pity in you for the black men who were slaves for 2 1/2 centuries. It would be foolish now to look back upon that in the light of injustice. Let us not be naive. Men do what they must. Even when they feel that they are being driven by God, even when they feel they are fulfilling the will of God. Those men were engaged in a struggle for life, and their choice in the matter was small indeed. It was the imperial dream of a feudal age that made men enslave others. Exalted by the will to rule, they could not have built nations on so vast a scale had they not shut their eyes to the humanity of other men, men whose lives were necessary for their building. But the invention and widespread use of machines made the further direct enslavement of men economically impossible. And so slavery ended. Let me, Your Honor, dwell a moment longer upon the danger of looking upon this boy in the light of injustice. If I should say that he is a victim of injustice, then I would be asking by implication for sympathy. And if one insists upon looking at this boy as a victim of injustice, he will be swamped by a feeling of guilt so strong as to be indistinguishable from hate. Of all things, men do not like to feel that they are guilty of wrong, and if you make them feel guilt, they will try desperately to justify it on any grounds. But failing that, and seeing no immediate solution that will set things right without too much cost to their lives and property, they will kill that which evoked in them the condemning sense of guilt. And this is true of all men, whether they be white or black. It is a peculiar and powerful but common need. Your Honor, let me give you an example. When this poor black boy, Bigger Thomas, was trying to cast the blame for his crime upon one of the witnesses, Jan Erlone, a communist, who faced this court yesterday, and this boy thought he would be able to blame his crime upon the communists with impunity, because the newspapers had convinced him that communists were criminals. An example of such fear guilt occurred. Jan Erlone confronted Bigger Thomas upon a street corner, and sought to have it out with him, demanding to know why Bigger was trying to blame the crime upon him. Jan Erlone told me that Bigger Thomas acted as hysterically as those people are acting at this moment in that mob outdoors. Bigger Thomas drew a gun and commanded Jan Erlone to leave him. Bigger Thomas was almost a stranger to Jan Erlone, and Jan Erlone was almost a stranger to him. Yet they hated each other. Today, Bigger Thomas and that mob are strangers. Yet, they hate. They hate because they fear, and they fear because they feel that the deepest feelings of their lives are being assaulted and outraged, and they do not know why. They are powerless pawns in a blind play of social forces. This guilt-fear is the basic tone of the prosecution and of the people in this case. In their hearts, they feel that a wrong has been done, and when a Negro commits a crime against them, they fancy they see the ghastly evidence of that wrong. So the men of wealth and property, the victims of attack who are eager to protect their profits, say to their guilty hirelings, "Stamp out this ghost." Or like Mr. Dalton, they say, "Let's do something for this man so he won't feel that way." but then it is too late. Do I say this to make you believe that this boy is blameless? No. Bigger Thomas's own feeling of hate feeds the feeling of guilt in others. Hemmed in, limited, circumscribed, he sees and feels no way of acting except to hate and kill that which he thinks is crushing him. Your Honor, I'm trying to wipe out this circle of blood, trying to cut down into this matter beneath hate and fear and guilt and revenge, and show what impulses are twisted. If only 10 or 20 Negroes had been put into slavery, we could call it injustice. But there were hundreds of thousands of them throughout the country. If this state of affairs had lasted for 2 or 3 years, we could say that it was unjust. But it lasted for more than 200 years. Injustice, which lasts for 3 long centuries, and which exists among millions of people, over thousands of square miles of territory, is injustice no longer. It is an accomplished fact of life. Men adjust themselves to their land. They create their own laws of being, their notions of right and wrong. A common way of earning a living gives them a common attitude toward life. Even their speech is colored and shaped by what they must undergo. Your Honor, injustice blots out one form of life, but another grows up in its place, with its own rights, needs, and aspirations. What is happening here today is not injustice, but oppression. An attempt to throttle or stamp out a new form of life. And it is this new form of life that has grown up here in our midst that puzzles us, that expresses itself like a weed growing from under a stone in terms we call crime. Unless we grasp this problem in the light of this new reality, we cannot do more than salve our feelings of guilt and rage with more murder when a man living under such conditions commits an act which we call a crime. This boy represents but a tiny aspect of a problem whose reality sprawls over a third of this nation. Kill him. Burn the life out of him. And still, when the delicate and unconscious machinery of race relations slips, there will be murder again. How can law contradict the lives of millions of people and hope to be administered successfully? Do we believe in magic? Do you believe that by burning a cross you can frighten a multitude, paralyze their will and impulses? Do you think that the white daughters in the homes of America will be any safer if you kill this boy? No. I tell you in all solemnity that they won't. The surest way to make certain that there will be more such murders is to kill this boy. In your rage and guilt, make thousands of other black men and women feel that the barriers are tighter and higher. Kill him, and swell the tide of pent-up lava that will someday break loose, not in a single, blundering, accidental individual crime, but in a wild cataract of emotion that will brook no control. The all-important thing for this court to remember in deciding this boy's fate is that though his crime was accidental, the emotions that broke loose were already there. The thing to remember is that this boy's way of life was a way of guilt, that his crime existed long before the murder of Mary Dalton, that the accidental nature of his crime took the guise of a sudden and violent rent in the veil behind which he lived, a rent which allowed his feelings of resentment and estrangement to leap forth and find objective and concrete form. obsessed with guilt. We have sought to thrust a corpse from before our eyes. We have marked off a little plot of ground and buried it. We tell our souls, in the deep of the black night, that it is dead, and that we have no reason for fear or uneasiness. But the corpse returns and raids our homes. We find our daughters murdered and burnt, and we say, kill, kill. But, Your Honor, I say stop. Let us look at what we are doing. For the corpse is not dead. It still lives. It has made itself a home in the wild forest of our great cities, amid the rank and choking vegetation of slums. It has forgotten our language. In order to live, it has sharpened its claws. It has grown hard and calloused. It has developed a capacity for hate and fury which we cannot understand. Its movements are unpredictable. By night, it creeps from its lair and steals toward the settlements of civilization. And at the sight of a kind face, it does not lie down upon its back and kick up its heels playfully to be tickled and stroked. No, it leaps to kill. Yes, Mary Dalton, a well-intentioned white girl with a smile upon her face, came to Bigger Thomas to help him. Mr. Dalton, feeling vaguely that a social wrong existed, wanted to give him a job so that his family could eat and his sister and brother could go to school. Mrs. Dalton, trying to grope her way toward a sense of decency, wanted him to go to school and learn a trade. But when they stretched forth their helping hands, death struck. Today they mourn and wait for revenge. The wheel of blood continues to turn. I have only sympathy for those kind-hearted white-haired parents. But to Mr. Dalton, who is a real estate operator, I say now, you rent houses to Negroes in the Black Belt, and you refuse to rent to them elsewhere. You kept Bigger Thomas in that forest. You kept the man who murdered your daughter a stranger to her. And you kept your daughter a stranger to him. The relationship between the Thomas family and the Dalton family was that of renter to landlord, customer to merchant, employee to employer. The Thomas family got poor, and the Dalton family got rich. And Mr. Dalton, a decent man, tried to salve his feelings by giving money. But my friend, gold was not enough. Corpses cannot be bribed. Say to yourself, Mr. Dalton, I offered my daughter as a burnt sacrifice, and it was not enough to push back into its grave this thing that haunts me. And to Mrs. Dalton I say, your philanthropy was as tragically blind as your sightless eyes. And to Mary Dalton, if she can hear me, I say, I stand here today trying to make your death mean something. Let me, Your Honor, explain further the meaning of Bigger Thomas's life. In him and men like him is what was in our forefathers when they first came to these strange shores hundreds of years ago. We were lucky. They are not. We found a land whose tasks called forth the deepest and best we had, and we built a nation, mighty and feared. We poured and are still pouring our soul into it. But we have told them, this is a white man's country. They are yet looking for a land whose tasks can call forth their deepest and best. This is not something that we have to be told. We know this. And in some of us, as in Mr. Dalton, the feeling of guilt stemming from our moral past is so strong that we try to undo this thing in a manner as naive as dropping a penny in a blind man's cup. But, Your Honor, life will not be dealt with in such a fashion. It rushes on, its fateful course mocking our delicate feelings. Let us hope that this court, at least, will indicate a line of action that is not childish. Consider, Your Honor, the peculiar position of this boy. He comes of a people who have lived under queer conditions of life, conditions thrust outside the normal circle of our civilization. But even in living outside of our lives, he has not had a full life of his own. We have seen to that. It was convenient to keep him close to us. It was nice and cheap. We told him what to do, where to live, how much schooling he could get, where he could eat, where and what kind of work he could do. We marked up the earth and said, "Stay there." But life is not stationary. He attended school, where he was taught what every white child was taught. But the moment he went through the door of the school into life, he knew that the white boy went one way and he went another. School stimulated and developed in him those impulses which all of us have. And then he was made to realize that he could not act upon them. Can the human mind devise a trap more skillful? This court should not sit to fix punishment for this boy. It should sit to ponder why there are not more like him. And there are, Your Honor. If it were not for the backwaters of religion, gambling, and sex draining off their energies into channels harmful to them and profitable to us, more of them would be here today, be assured. Your Honor, consider the mere physical aspect of our civilization. How alluring, how dazzling it is. How it excites the senses. How it seems to dangle within easy reach of everyone the fulfillment of happiness. How constantly and overwhelmingly the advertisements, radios, newspapers, and movies play upon us. But in thinking of them, remember that to many, they are tokens of mockery. These bright colors may fill our hearts with elation, but to many, they are daily taunts. Imagine a man walking amid such a scene, a part of it, and yet knowing that it is not for him. We planned the murder of Mary Dalton, and today we come to court and say we had nothing to do with it. But every schoolteacher knows that this is not so. For every schoolteacher knows the restrictions which have been placed upon Negro education. The authorities know that it is not so, for they have made it plain in their every act that they mean to keep Bigger Thomas and his kind within rigid limits. All real estate operators know that it is not so, for they have agreed among themselves to keep Negroes within the ghetto areas of cities. Your Honor, we who sit here today in this courtroom are witnesses. We know this evidence, for we helped to create it. It is not my duty here today to say how this great problem can be solved. My job is to show how nonsensical it is to seek revenge on this boy under the pretense that we are making a great fight for justice. If we do that, we shall be merely hypnotizing ourselves, and to our own ultimate disadvantage. But the question may be asked, if this boy thought that he was somehow wrong, why did he not go into a court of law and seek a redress of his grievances? Why should he take the law into his own hands? Your Honor, this boy had no notion before he murdered, and he has none now, of having been wronged by any specific individuals. And to be honest with you, the very life he has led has created in him a frame of mind which makes him expect much less of this court than you will ever know. It is indeed unfortunate that Mary Dalton should have been the woman who approached him that night. And it is unfortunate that Jan Erlone should have been the man who sought to help him. He murdered one and tried to lay the blame for that murder on the other, But Jan and Mary were not human beings to Bigger Thomas. Social custom had shoved him so far away from them that they were not real to him. What would a boy, free from the warping influences which have played so hard upon Bigger Thomas, have done that night when he found himself alone with that drunk girl? He would have gone to Mr. or Mrs. Dalton and told them that their daughter was drunk, and the thing would have been over. There would have been no murder. But the way we have treated this boy made him do the very thing we did not want. Or am I wrong? Maybe we wanted him to do it. Maybe we would have had no chance or justification to stage attacks against hundreds of thousands of people if he had acted sanely and normally. Maybe we would have had to go to the expensive length of inventing theories to justify our attacks if we had treated him fairly. This boy's crime was not an act of retaliation by an injured man against a person who he thought had injured him. If it were, then this case would be simple indeed. This is the case of a man's mistaking a whole race of men as a part of the natural structure of the universe, and of his acting toward them accordingly. He murdered Mary Dalton accidentally, without thinking, without plan, without conscious motive. But after he murdered, he accepted the crime. And that's the important thing. It was the first full act of his life. It was the most meaningful, exciting, and stirring thing that had ever happened to him. He accepted it because it made him free, gave him the possibility of choice, of action, the opportunity to act and to feel that his actions carried weight. We are dealing here with an impulse stemming from deep down. We are dealing here not with how man acts toward man, but with how a man acts when he feels that he must defend himself against or adapt himself to the total natural world in which he lives. The central fact to be understood here is not who wronged this boy, but what kind of vision of the world did he have before his eyes? And where did he get such a vision as to make him, without premeditation, snatch the life of another person so quickly and instinctively that even though there was an element of accident in it, he was willing after the crime to say, "Yes, I did it. I had to." I know that it is the fashion these days for a defendant to say, "Everything went blank to me." But this boy does not say that. He says the opposite. He says he knew what he was doing and felt he had to do it. And he says he feels no sorrow for having done it. Do men regret when they kill in war? Does the personality of a soldier coming at you over the top of a trench matter? No. You kill to keep from being killed. And after a victorious war, you return to a free country, just as this boy, with his hands stained with the blood of Mary Dalton, felt that he was free for the first time in his life. Your Honor, the most pathetic aspect of this case is that a young white woman, a student at a university, ignorant and thoughtless, though educated, tried to undo as an individual a gigantic wrong accomplished by a nation through 300 long years, and was misunderstood and is now dead because of that misunderstanding. It has been said that the proof of the corrupt and vile heart of this boy is that he slew a woman who was trying to be kind to him. In the face of that assertion, I ask the question, is there any greater proof that his heart is not corrupt and vile than that he slew a woman who was trying to be kind. Oh, yes. He hated the girl. And why not? She was acting toward him in such a way as no white face usually acts toward a Negro. And as a white face acts only when it is about to fleece a Negro of something. He did not understand her. She confounded him. Her actions made him feel that the entire universe was tumbling about his head. What would any man in this courtroom do if the sun should suddenly turn green? Look, Your Honor, with great and elaborate care, we conditioned Mary Dalton so that she would regard Bigger Thomas as a kind of beast. And under the penalty of death, we commanded Bigger Thomas to avoid Mary Dalton. Fateful circumstances threw them together. Is it surprising that one of them is dead and the other is on trial for his life? Look, Your Honor, even in this courtroom, even here today, Negro and white are separated. See those Negroes sitting together behind that railing? No one told them to sit there. They sat there because they knew that we did not want them on the same bench with us. Multiply Bigger Thomas 12 million times, allowing for environmental and temperamental variations, and for those Negroes who are completely under the influence of the church, and you have the psychology of the Negro people. But once you see them as a whole, once your eyes leave the individual and encompass the mass, a new quality comes into the picture. Taken collectively, they are not simply 12 million people. In reality, they constitute a separate nation. Stunted, stripped, and held captive within this nation, devoid of political, social, economic, and property rights. Do you think that you can kill one of them, even if you killed one every day in the year, and make the others so full of fear that they would not kill? No. Such a foolish policy has never worked and never will. The more you kill, the more you deny and separate, the more will they seek another form and way of life, however blindly and unconsciously. And out of what can they weave a different life? Out of what can they mold a new existence, living organically in the same towns and cities, the same neighborhoods with us? I ask, out of what? But what we are and own. We allow them nothing. We allowed Bigger Thomas nothing. He sought another life, and accidentally found one. Found it at the expense of all that we cherish and hold dear. Men once oppressed our forefathers to the extent that they viewed other men as material out of which to build a nation. We, in turn, have oppressed others to such a degree that they, fumblingly as yet, try to construct meaningful lives out of us. Cannibalism still lives. Your Honor, there are 4 times as many Negroes in America today as there were people in the original 13 colonies when they struck for their freedom. These 12 million Negroes, conditioned broadly by our own notions as we were by European ones when we first came here, are struggling within unbelievably narrow limits to achieve that feeling of at-homeness for which we once strove so ardently. And compared with our own struggle, they are striving under conditions far more difficult. If anybody can, surely we ought to be able to understand what these people are after. This vast stream of life, dammed and muddied, is trying to sweep toward that fulfillment which all of us seek so fondly, but find so impossible to put into words. When we said that men are endowed with certain inalienable rights, Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We did not pause to define happiness. That is the unexpressed quality in our quest, and we have never tried to put it into words. That is why we say, let each man serve God in his own fashion. But there are some broad features of the kind of happiness we are seeking which are known. We know that happiness comes to men when they are caught up, absorbed in a meaningful task or duty to be done, a task or duty which in turn sheds justification and sanction back down upon their humble labors. We know that this may take many forms. In religion, it is the story of the creation of man, of his fall, and of his redemption, compelling men to order their lives in certain ways, all cast in terms of cosmic images and symbols which swallow the soul in fullness and wholeness. In art, science, industry, politics, and social action, it may take other forms. But these 12 million Negroes have access to none of these highly crystallized modes of expression, save that of religion. And many of them know religion only in its most primitive form. The environment of tense urban centers has all but paralyzed the impulse for religion as a way of life for them today, just as it has for us. Feeling the capacity to be, to live, to act, to pour out the spirit of their souls into concrete and objective form with a high fervor born of their racial characteristics, they glide through our complex civilization like wailing ghosts. They spin like fiery planets lost from their orbits. They wither and die like trees ripped from native soil. Your Honor, remember that men can starve from a lack of self-realization as much as they can from a lack of bread, and they can murder for it too. Did we not build a nation? Did we not wage war and conquer in the name of a dream to realize our personalities and to make those realized personalities secure? Do we think that the laws of human nature stopped operating after we had got our feet upon our road? Have we had to struggle so hard for our right to happiness that we have all but destroyed the conditions under which we and others can still be happy? This Negro boy, Bigger Thomas, is a part of a furious blaze of liquid life energy which once blazed and is still blazing in our land. He is a hot jet of life that spattered itself in futility against a cold wall. But did Bigger Thomas really murder? At the risk of offending the sensibilities of this court, I ask the question in the light of the ideals by which we live. Looked at from the outside, maybe it was murder. Yes. But to him, it was not murder. If it was murder, then what was the motive? The prosecution has shouted, stormed, and threatened, but he has not said why Bigger Thomas killed. He has not said why, because he does not know. The truth is, Your Honor, there was no motive, as you and I understand motives, within the scope of our laws today. The truth is, this boy did not kill. Oh, yes, Mary Dalton is dead. Bigger Thomas smothered her to death. Bessie Mears is dead. Bigger Thomas battered her with a brick in an abandoned building. But did he murder? Did he kill? Listen. What Bigger Thomas did early that Sunday morning in the Dalton home, and what he did that Sunday night in that empty building, was but a tiny aspect of what he had been doing all his life long. He was living, only as he knew how, and as we have forced him to live. The actions that resulted in the death of those two women were as instinctive and inevitable as breathing or blinking one's eyes. It was an act of creation. Let me tell you more. Before this trial, the newspapers and the prosecution said that this boy had committed other crimes. It is true. He is guilty of numerous crimes. But search until the day of judgment, and you will not find one shred of evidence of them. He has murdered many times, but there are no corpses. Let me explain. This Negro boy's entire attitude toward life is a crime. The hate and fear which we have inspired in him, woven by our civilization into the very structure of his consciousness, into his blood and bones, into the hourly functioning of his personality, have become the justification for his existence. Every time he comes in contact with us, he kills. It is a physiological and psychological reaction embedded in his being. Every thought he thinks is potential murder. Excluded from and unassimilated in our society, yet longing to gratify impulses akin to our own, but denied the objects and channels evolved through long centuries for their socialized expression, every sunrise and sunset makes him guilty of subversive actions. Every movement of his body is an unconscious protest. Every desire, every dream, no matter how intimate or personal, is a plot or a conspiracy. Every hope is a plan for insurrection. Every glance of the eye is a threat. His very existence is a crime against the state. It so happened that night a white girl was present in her bed and a Negro boy was standing over her, fascinated with fear, hating her. A blind woman walked into the room and that Negro boy killed that girl to keep from being discovered in a position which he knew, we claimed, warrants the death penalty. But that is only one side of it. He was impelled toward murder as much through the thirst for excitement, exultation, and elation as he was through fear. It was his way of living. Your Honor, in our blindness, we have so contrived and ordered the lives of men that the moths in their hearts flutter toward ghoulish and incomprehensible flames. I have not explained the relationship of Bessie Mears to this boy. I have not forgotten her. I omitted to mention her until now, because she was largely omitted from the consciousness of Bigger Thomas. His relationship to this poor black girl also reveals his relationship to the world. But Bigger Thomas is not here on trial for having murdered Bessie Mears, and he knows that. What does this mean? Does not the life of a Negro girl mean as much in the eyes of the law as the life of a white girl? Yes, perhaps. In the abstract. But under the stress of fear and flight, Bigger Thomas did not think of Bessie. He could not. The attitude of America toward this boy regulated his most intimate dealings with his own kind. After he had killed Mary Dalton, he killed Bessie Mears to silence her, to save himself. After he had killed Mary Dalton, the fear of having killed a white woman filled him to the exclusion of everything else. He could not react to Bessie's death. His consciousness was determined by the fear that hung above him. But one might ask, did he not love Bessie? Was she not his girl? Yes, she was his girl. He had to have a girl, so he had Bessie. But he did not love her. Is love possible to the life of a man I've described to this court? Let us see. Love is not based upon sex alone. And that is all he had with Bessie. He wanted more, but the circumstances of his life and her life would not allow it. And the temperament of both Bigger and Bessie kept it out. Love grows from stable relationships, shared experience, loyalty, devotion, trust. Neither Bigger nor Bessie had any of these. What was there they could hope for? There was no common vision binding their hearts together. There was no common hope steering their feet in a common path. Even though they were intimately together, they were confoundingly alone. They were physically dependent upon each other, and they hated that dependence. Their brief moments together were for purposes of sex. They loved each other as much as they hated each other. Perhaps they hated each other more than they loved. Sex warms the deep roots of life. It is the soil out of which the tree of love grows. But these were trees without roots. Trees that live by the light of the sun in what chance rain that fell upon stony ground. Can disembodied spirits love? There existed between them fitful splurges of physical elation. That's all. With cunning calculated to outrage the moral sense, the prosecution brought into this courtroom a man, a manager from a theater, who told us that Bigger Thomas and boys like him frequented his theater and committed acts of masturbation in the darkened seats. A gasp of horror went through the courtroom. But what is so strange about that? Was not Bigger Thomas's relationship to his girl a masturbatory one? Was not his relationship to the whole world on the same plane? His entire existence was one long craving for satisfaction, with the objects of satisfaction denied. And we regulated every part of the world he touched. Through the instrument of fear, we determine the mode and the quality of his consciousness. Your Honor, is this boy alone in feeling deprived and baffled? Is he an exception? Or are there others? There are others, Your Honor, millions of others, Negro and white, and that is what makes our future seem a looming image of violence. The feeling of resentment and the balked longing for some kind of fulfillment and exultation, in degrees more or less intense and in actions more or less conscious, stalk day by day through this land. The consciousness of Bigger Thomas and millions of others more or less like him, white and black, according to the weight of the pressure we have put upon them, form the quicksand upon which the foundations of our civilization rest. Who knows when some slight shock, disturbing the delicate balance between social order and thirsty aspiration, shall send the skyscrapers in our cities toppling. Does that sound fantastic? I assure you that it is no more fantastic than those troops and that waiting mob whose presence and guilty anger portend something which we dare not even think. Your Honor, Bigger Thomas was willing to vote for and follow any man who would have let him out of his morass of pain and hate and fear. If that mob outdoors is afraid of one man, what will it feel when millions rise? How soon will someone speak the word? The resentful millions will understand the word to be, to act, to live. Is this court so naive as to think that they will not take a chance that is even less risky than that Bigger Thomas took? Let us not concern ourselves with that part of Bigger Thomas's confession that says he murdered accidentally, that he did not rape the girl. It really does not matter. What does matter is that he was guilty before he killed. That was why his whole life became so quickly and naturally organized, pointed, charged with a new meaning when this thing occurred. Who knows when another accident involving millions of men will happen? An accident that will be the dreadful day of our doom. Lodged in the heart of this moment is the question of power, which time will unfold. Your Honor, another civil war in these states is not impossible. And if the misunderstanding of what this boy's life means is an indication of how men of wealth and property are misreading the consciousness of the submerged millions today, one may truly come. Listen, I've talked with this boy. He has no education. He is poor. He is black. And you know what we have made those things mean in our country. He is young and not yet thoroughly experienced in the ways of life. He is unmarried and does not know the steadying influence of a woman's love or what such a love can mean to him. I say I talked with him. Did I find ambition there? Yes. But it was blurred and hazy, with no notion of where it was to find an outlet. He knew he did not have a chance. He believed it. His ambition was chained, held back, a pool of stagnant water. I say I talked with him. Did he have the hope of a better life? Yes. But he kept it down under rigid control. He moved through our crowded streets, drove our cars for us, waited upon our tables, ran our elevators, holding this thing tightly down in him. In every town and city, you see him laughing, because we pay and expect him to laugh. What would happen if he wanted to get with the very atmosphere of our times has taught him as well as us that every man should have if he is able-bodied, of average intelligence, and sane? You know as well as I, there would be riots. Your Honor, if ever there was the unpredictable in our midst, this is it. I do not propose that we try to solve this entire problem here in this courtroom today. That is not within the province of our duty, nor even, I think, within the scope of our ability. But our decision as to whether this black boy is to live or die can be made in accordance with what actually exists. It will at least indicate that we see and know. And our seeing and knowing will comprise a consciousness of how inescapably this one man's life will confront us 10 million-fold in the days to come. I ask that you spare this boy. Send him to prison for life. I ask this not because I want to, but because I feel I must. I speak under the threat of mob rule and have no desire to intensify the already existing hate. What would prison mean to Bigger Thomas? It holds advantages for him that a life of freedom never had. To send him to prison would be more than an act of mercy. You would be, for the first time, conferring life upon him. He would be brought for the first time within the orbit of our civilization. He would have an identity, even though it be but a number. He would have, for the first time, an openly designated relationship with the world. The very building in which he would spend the rest of his natural life would be the best he has ever known. Sending him to prison would be the first recognition of his personality he has ever had. The long, black, empty years ahead would constitute for his mind and feelings the only certain and durable object around which he could build a meaning for his life.